Shia, of course, we believe that the true path is the path of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, but doesn't mean that we believe all the other Muslims or even non-Muslims, the followers of other religions, they will go to the hellfire and they will not be saved. Not at all. The issue of truth or haq is something, and the issue of salvation is something else.
It's not a matter, it's entirely.
Yeah, according to the verses of the Quran and narrations, at least some people, if not many, the majority, they are called mustadhaf, meaning that they have tried their best to find the truth, but for any reason they were not able to find the truth. So we can imagine that, for example, some Christians, they have tried their best to find the truth, and they have found it to be Christianity, or our Sunni brothers, they have found it to be Sunni school of thought, not Shia school of thought. According to the narrations from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, these people will be saved on the Day of Judgment. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is all compassionate, and His mercy will include, of course, the people who have done their best to find the truth, but for any reason they were not able, but they acted upon their understanding and
they finding. Deserve His mercy and kindness because they tried at the very least.
So the issue of haq or truth is different from the issue of salvation. Having said that, first of all, we need to see, based on the verses of the Quran, whether being the majority is a criterion for being on the true path or not. We see that on the this is not the case. Rather, according to many verses in the Quran, Allah says that the majority of the people, they do not follow the true path. Again, I do want to say that because of these verses, Ahlul Sunnah, they are not following the true path. This is another.
Not say that. No.
Yeah.
Of course not.
The point is that, is being the majority a criterion for being on the true path? The answer is that, according to the Noble Book of Quran, the answer is negative. Rather, the verses of the Quran tell us that almost in all the cases, the majority of the people, they are...
have been in the wrong, actually.
Yeah, they are in the wrong direction. Let me share some of the verses in this regard. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, for example, in chapter Al-An'am, verse 116, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَإِن تُطِعْ أَكْثَرَ مَن فِي الْأَرْضِ يُضِلُّكَ عَن سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. If you follow the majority of the people on the earth, they will lead you astray from the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَإِنَّ كَثِيرًا لَيُضِلُّونَ بِأَفْوَاهِهِمْ بِغَيْرِ عِلْمٍ. Again, chapter Al-An'am, verse 119. The majority of the people, they, without any knowledge, they will follow the wrong direction. وَمَا يَتَّبَعُ أَكْثَرُهُمْ إِلَّا ظَنَّا. Chapter Yunus, verse 36. Most of them, they do not follow but their, conjectures, not the knowledge. أكثرهم للحق كارهون. Most of them, they reject haq and truth. وما كان أكثر. This is in chapter Mu'minun, verse 70. وما كان أكثرهم مؤمنين. Most of them, they are not believers. Shu'ara, verse 8. وقليل من عبادي الشكور. Saba, verse 13. Only few of my servants, they are thankful. وما أكثر الناس ولو حرصت بالمؤمنين. Chapter Yusuf, verse 103. Most of the people, they are not going to believe in you, although you that, meaning the Prophet, you try your best. So you see, not
it's
only
very
being,
evident, yeah, according to the Quran, that being in majority does not mean that you are right or righteous.
Yeah, and what has happened in the history is that the majority of the people, they have followed the wrong path.
It's a proof of just that, exactly.
Again, we do not claim that in our time and era, being the majority is a criterion for following the wrong path. No, it is not a criterion for following the true path or the wrong path. The second point is that if we consider being the majority as the criterion for following the true path, then one of the consequences is that the Christianity must be the true path. Because the majority of the people nowadays in the world, they are following Christianity.
They outnumber the Muslims.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
According to some statistics, they are 33% of the population, of the world population, and the Muslims are 23%. So if this is the true logic, then all the Sunnis and Shi'as, they should abandon their religion and follow Christianity, because the majority of the people, they are following Christianity.
Yeah, we were right.
Exactly. They need to be right. If some Sunnis, they want to say that, Sunnis as a denomination, they outnumber other denominations, like they outnumber Catholics, they outnumber Protestants. The answer is that Sunnis, they have different denominations when it comes to jurisprudence and theology as well. So we have four schools of jurisprudence. When it comes to theology, we have Asharis, Mu'tazilis, Maturidis. Also, we have some Salafis, Wahhabis. So they are not in the same line as well. I mean, we have different categories among the Sunnis as well. The next point is a narration from one of the important Sunni sources written by the great Sunni scholar At-Tabarani, Al-Mu'jam al-Awsat, volume 7, page 370. In this narration, I'm quoting this narration because we are answering our Sunni brothers to see that whether this is a criterion to be the majority or not.
Of course.
The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family is quoted as saying, مَخْتَلَفَ أُمَّةٌ بَعْدَ نَبِيِّهَا إِلَّا زَهَرَ أَهْلُ بَاطِلَهَا عَلَىٰ أَهْلِ حَقِّهَا. Each nation that, came to differences after their prophet, what happened was that the people of falsehood defeated the people of the truth. So whenever we have a disagreement among the followers and the nation of a prophet, what happens after that is that the followers of the falsehood, they outnumber the followers of the truth.
So the truthful, righteous ones, they get outnumbered, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, we are not going to say that...
We will not comment on this. Yeah. It's just food for thought. You
exactly.
Can
just to
on
mention
this yourselves.
That this is not the criterion. And let me share some other narrations which also quoted by Sunni scholars in their sources. For example, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in a very beautiful narration, is quoted as saying, إِنَّ الْحَقَّ لَا يُعَرَفُ بِالرِّجَالِ. Truth is not known by the people, meaning that people who, claim to be following the truth, or it means people who claim to follow the truth. فَعْرِفَ الْحَقْ تَعْرِفْ أَهْلَ. You need to know the truth, then you will know the people of the truth.
So know the truth first, then you will see it in the truthful people, and not vice versa.
Whether they are the majority or the minority. Being majority of minority doesn't prove anything. What matters is knowing the truth. It has been mentioned, it is a famous narration in both Shia and Sunni sources. Among the Shia sources, I may refer to Wasa'ir al-Shia, volume 27, page 135. And as for the Sunni scholars, it's been mentioned by Manawi in Fayd al-Qadir, volume 1, page 28. And also Qurtubi in his Tafsir, volume 1, page 340. Imam Ali Salam also mentions in another narration, أَيُّهَا النَّاسِ, O people, لَا تَسْتَوْحَشُوا فِي تَرِيقِ الْهُدَى لِقِلَّةِ أَهْلِهِ. Do not be afraid and terrified in the way of guidance because of the fact that people of guidance are small in number. So this
so
is not
don't
the
worry if you are few believers in this
exactly.
community or nation, for example.
Yeah, this is not the criterion. This is another narration. As mentioned by Imam Ali alayhi salam. Interestingly, during the battle of Camel or Jamal, a person asked Imam Ali alayhi salam that maybe he asked the same question. He told the Imam that all these people who are against you, they are the majority. Their number is higher than the number of your followers. How is it possible that they are, with battle, with falsehood, and you, that is, Imam Ali alayhi salam, who is the leader of the minority, you are with the truth. Then Imam Ali alayhi salam mentioned the following narration, which is very powerful. إِنَّ الْحَقَّ وَالْبَاطِلَ لَا يُعْرَفَانْ بِأَقْدَارِ الرِّجَالِ. Again, truth and falsehood are not known through the number of the people who follow.
It's not a criterion.
Or claim to follow them. Again, اعرف الحق تعرف أهله. If you want to follow the true path, you need to find the truth. You shouldn't pay attention to the people who claim that we are the followers of the truth. No. ف first know the truth, ta'arif ahla. If you know the truth, then you will know the people of the truth.
We also have a very clear example of this that is both accepted by our Sunni brothers and us Shias, mm-hmm. being Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the grandson of the Prophet who was slaughtered along with his 72 companions.
Exactly.
And they were vastly outnumbered, but that's we do not accept that he was in the wrong, of course.
And our Sunni brothers, I think in this case, they also agree that in that case, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was, the symbol of truth, and the army of Umar ibn Sa'd and Yazid, they were the army of Satan and falsehood.
The tyrants.
Yeah. And Imam alayhi salam continues, اعرف الباطل تعرف أهله. If you want to know the falsehood, batil as well, first of all, know batil in and of itself. If you know that, then you would be able to know the people who follow falsehood. Again, it has been mentioned by both Shia and Sunnis. Among the Sunni sources, I may refer to Ansab al-Ashraf, volume Ansab al-Ashraf, page 238. So the conclusion is that, as I mentioned, being the minority or majority is not at all a criterion for knowing the truth. In some period in history, maybe, as I mentioned, according to the verses of the Quran, almost in all the period, the majority of the people, they have followed the wrong path. In our time, we know that as Muslims, whether Shia and Sunni, we see that the majority of the people are following Christianity. And according to us, Shia, and according to our Sunni brothers, they are not following the true path. And so the point is that this is not the criterion. People could be with falsehood and be the majority and vice versa. And it may only happen after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam that the almost all the people, they will follow Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam.
God willing,
because inshallah, because there is a difference among the scholars whether we'll have other religions at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But the point is that at least the great majority of the people will follow the truth at that time.
And to just add one final example of this majority argument being false, the Prophet himself and the Muslims, when Islam, the cradle of Islam first started, were the vast, vast majority.
Yeah.
But they did not look to the mushrikeen, to the polytheists of Quraysh, and say, they're more than we are and they must be right. They never even mentioned this logic.
That's true.
Exactly. So, dear Sheikh, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Our program is unfortunately up. And this has been your host, Musa al-Bahadiri, from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRRB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Economic Divide. is often called the biggest U.S. double standard. The U.S. not only possesses and maintains nuclear weapons, but lectures the world on the threat, like from Iran, on the virtues of nuclear nonproliferation. At the same time, it is upgrading its nuclear arsenal to the tune of between $1 to $2 trillion. Hi, I'm Kavit Atlay. Welcome to this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, U.S. nuclear weapons upgrade, the development of new U.S. air, land, and sea-based nuclear systems, dubbed the Nuclear Triad, part of the U.S. strategic doctrine. The U.S. says that they must be modernized, but for whom and against what? Meanwhile, the U.S. President Joe Biden has said that it would review the $1.2 trillion nuclear modernization program. He said that he would trim funding for nuclear weapons and will reduce the role in the Pentagon strategy. Also, we will take a look at how the U.S. says its nuclear weapons are for nuclear deterrence, exaggerating threats coming from China, Russia, and Iran, at the same time sanctioning these countries, preventing their economic advancement. Or is that the real aim?
Intercontinental ballistic missiles, strategic nuclear bombers, and submarine-launched ballistic missiles. The U.S. views them as its three pillars in the nuclear policy. The U.S. says that the atomic warheads and transport means introduced during the Cold War are falling behind. It claims that they need to be modernized. For that reason, the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama approved the modernization plans to replace them with the latest ones, to the tune of between $1.2 to $2 trillion over the course of 30 years. Ironic that the former U.S. president was presented as being in a nuclear paradox, pushing for cuts, yet to have agreed to upgrades. At least with Donald Trump, the view was clear.
Three legs of the triad, though. Do you have a priority? Because I want to go to Senator Rubio
that. I think for me, nuclear is just the power, the devastation is very important to me.
It was reported not that long ago that the Biden administration was actually incorporating a new $100 billion nuclear missile system. Now, that was misleading, since this was actually part of the U.S. nuclear upgrade and modernization that was initiated during the Obama years. Now, this is a story in a nutshell. According to a 2019 Congressional Budget Office report, the U.S. is committed to spending about $500 billion, $494 billion to be exact, on its nuclear forces over the next decade. That adds up to be about $50 billion per year. Over the next three decades, nuclear weapons modernization plans could cost as much as between $1.2 or $1.5 to $2 trillion.
The U.S. already directs about 5.5% of its defense budget just toward its nuclear forces. And the cost is expected to rise with the arsenal's modernization needs and could swallow up to 8% of defense spending by the late 2020s.
The current modernization program, to the best we can see, is not sustainable economically. So we'd have to cut some conventional programs and use that on nuclear instead. And that's a huge dilemma inside military planning.
Well, the guest for this segment of the Q&A is Behrad Nahai. He's a nuclear scientist and engineer. He's also a social activist. I'd like to welcome you. Let's take a look at the U.S. claims that the sole purpose of the U.S. nuclear arsenal should actually be deterrence, but it has cited Russia and China as national security threats. This type of nuclear buildup not only initiated a Cold War, but it appears that the U.S. wants to also have leverage on these countries, both politically and economically. Is this how this can be viewed?
Well, as said this correctly, we have to look at the baseline. In the 70s, after opening to China, the United States, not the government, the industry, without objection of the government, or probably with the encouragement of government, started to export its industry, the software part of it, to India, because they already knew the language, so they can interact and the hardware to China because cheap labor.
It's time for our in-depth section of the program. The theory that nuclear weapons are decreasing in numbers and that there was an end to the Cold War, that no longer holds true. Now, one of the reasons is the U.S. insistence on nuclear weapons modernization and nuclear upgrades. Let's first take a look at nuclear stockpiles of other countries. We're going to go back to the year 2013 in order to do that and take a look at Russia, for example, at that time. 8,500 nuclear weapons it possessed. The U.S. had 7,700. This includes deployed and reserved warheads. Now, China at the time had 250 nuclear warheads. Now, fast forward to the year 2020. You can see that the number of nuclear warheads, weapons, is decreasing. As of the end of that year, the number for the U.S., for example, stood at 5,800. Russia, it stood at 6,375. So there was a decrease. But notice China. Now, China, that increased its nuclear warheads. It was 250 to 320. From China's point of view, since the U.S. sees it as a national security threat, it has increased its military capabilities, of which nuclear weapons is part of its program. Now, the former U.S. President Donald Trump, who was not the first U.S. president to go after the expansion of U.S. nuclear arsenal, certainly glorified the building and the expansion of nuclear weapons.
I think we can do a lot of things militarily also. For instance, they're making a lot of weapons, tremendous weapons, and so are we. We just had $716 billion approved for military last year. Now we're possibly going to do more this year. And between Russia and China and us, we're all making hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons, including nuclear, which is ridiculous. And I would say that China will come along, and I would say Russia will come along. It doesn't really make sense that we're all doing this. I think we're the leader. I think we're always going to be the leader. We have to be the leader. I think it's much better if we all got together and we didn't make these weapons.
Donald Trump for you and his way of explaining things. Well, the U.S. nuclear modernization and upgrade program, however, is in fifth gear. Now, did you know that the U.S. actually has a nuclear strike command? It's called Air Force Global Strike Command. Well, that's appropriate. And it's a major command of the United States Air Force, headquartered at Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana. AFGSC provides combat-ready forces to conduct strategic nuclear strikes and global strike operations in support of combatant commanders. And this is their state of mind these days.
The U.S. Air Force's Nuclear Command says it's about to undergo a major reorganization as it prepares to field new bombs, missiles, bombers, and rockets. Air Force Global Strike Command stood up in 2009 as the successor to Strategic Air Command, which maintained around-the-clock nuclear alerts during the Cold War. Today, the command's 34,000 personnel oversee 20 B-2 stealth bombers, 76 B-52 bombers, and 450 Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles, together capable of delivering thousands of nuclear warheads.
Yeah, this type of stuff really boggles the mind. All right, and when you thought it couldn't get worse, it actually does. The U.S. is actually getting this. It's a $100 billion nuclear weapon, a new weapon of mass destruction, a nuclear missile that's the length of a bowling lane. It's going to be able to travel some 6,000 miles. It's going to carry a warhead, or it can carry a warhead, more than 20 times more powerful than the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. It will be able to kill hundreds of thousands of people in a single shot. The U.S. Air Force plans to order more than 600 of them.
Close your door. Open.
America is building a new weapon of mass destruction, a nuclear missile the length of a bowling lane. It will be able to travel some 6,000 miles, carrying a warhead more than 20 times more powerful than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. It will be able to kill hundreds of thousands of people in a single shot. The U.S. Air Force plans to order more than 600 of them.
Yeah, go figure that out. 600 at $100 billion for each. Okay, another case for alarm. We've said so many of them. Well, that's the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile around the world, the secret U.S. nuke locations. Not so secret, obviously, we know where the locations are in terms of the countries anyways. We got their position around the world. We got the Netherlands, Belgium. Italy has two locations where you have these nuclear warheads, Germany and Turkey. In terms of the total nuclear, I guess, warheads that's in these different locations, which includes B-61 nuclear weapons, they're roughly about 150. And what is ironic about this whole nuclear affair is where the money can we spend in the U.S.? I mean, if you think about it, can't the U.S. government spend the money on, for example, hunger? Take a look at this chart over here. You're looking at the U.S. military spending as a whole, roughly looking at about $700 to $800 billion, okay? Out of that, you're looking at about $50 billion for nuclear weapons, which some say that could is going to increase monumentally. It could go up to $100 billion. That's yearly. That's also per year, the nuclear or the military spending. Now here, you have food assistance. In the U.S., between 30 to 40 million Americans need assistance for food. They don't have enough money for food. The money runs out for families. Don't you think that, which amounts to about $70 to $80 billion that the U.S. government actually dishes out for that? Don't you think that out of all this money, which in total is $700 to $800 billion for U.S. military spending, that $70 or $80 billion could be spent on helping Americans who are hungry? That is the key question over here. Now, in terms of the total number of people who are on this, as I mentioned, it's between 30 to 40 million people. Let's not forget this nuclear spending is something that has a lot of opposition.
My very serious concerns about our nation's bloated military budget, particularly in light of the many unmet needs we face as a nation. Also, I must express a very serious objection to the fact that we are dealing with a $716 billion piece of legislation that is more than half of the discretionary budget, and yet we will, in all likelihood, not have a process which allows for amendments to be debated. $716 billion at a time when in Louisiana, as I understand it, they're now going to be cutting food stamps for hungry children, where schools throughout this country don't have enough money for books or for teachers' salaries. We're talking about a $716 billion military budget, and this process, as I understand it, will allow for no amendments, despite the fact that I think virtually every member of the Senate has concerns about this bill.
Okay. What's incredible about this is the fact that Bernie Sanders, aside from how he clearly describes this scenario, is that there are no amendments, so this is going to get passed. Nobody can argue against the figure for the military spending. Okay, let's bring in Scott Ritter here. He is the former UN chief weapons inspector. He was a critic of the U.S. foreign policy in West Asia and prior to the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. He stated that Iraq possessed no significant weapons of mass destruction. Scott, welcome. The U.S. claims that the sole purpose of the U.S. nuclear arsenal should be deterrence, but it has cited Russia and China as national security threats. This type of nuclear buildup not only initiated a Cold War, based on what many have said, but it appears that the U.S. wants to also have leverage, both politically and economically, over China and Russia. Is this how this can be viewed, do you think?
Well, first of all, I mean, it doesn't do the argument any good to compare nuclear weapons with impoverished Americans. They don't factor into the debate. There's always been starving Americans, and since 1945, America's always had nuclear weapons, and never the two shall meet. So I understand the sentiment, but you know, the same argument could be made for you know, conventional military forces. Why do we spend so much money invading and occupying Iraq? Why do we spend so much money bombing Syria? Why do we spend so much money in a 20-year war in Afghanistan when we have starving Americans?
U.S. believes that China and Russia want to shape a world consistent with their model, gaining veto over other nations' economic, diplomatic, and security decisions. But the U.S. nuclear modernization and military buildup may have nothing to do with China's military. In other words, it is not China's military that the U.S. sees as a threat, but their economy and their technology. Smartphones come from China. Phone commerce via a messaging app is commonplace. China's home to Huawei, Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, and Xiaomi. Then comes massive investments in AI and 5G. Just in 5G, China's getting one of the world's largest 5G deployments. 5G is already available in 50 cities in China, and 130,000 5G base stations are about to go live. What's more, China is also home to two-thirds of global investment into artificial intelligence, recently replacing the U.S. And China is projected to take over the U.S. as the number one economy, which begs the question, how can the U.S. stop China replacing it unless through military force?
When it comes to the nuclear energy industry, not nuclear weapons, the U.S. boasts about how good that is for the economy. The U.S. says that the nuclear industry powers the nation and communities, that it provides enormous economic benefits and is critical to U.S.'s national security, serving as a reliable energy source. Some of the advantages: supports nearly 500,000 jobs in the U.S., contributes an estimated $60 billion to the U.S. gross domestic product each year. Nuclear energy contributes $10 billion in federal taxes yearly, adding $60 billion to the country's GDP. This happened for the year 2018. And on average, a nuclear energy facility generates $470 million in sales of goods and services annually in the local community and $40 million annually in labor income. Okay, let's bring in both of our guests now to see whether their thoughts converge on this or not. Scott Ritter and Behrad Nahai join us. I'm going to first turn to you, Scott. The U.S. not only possesses and maintains around 6,000 nuclear weapons, that's come down roughly, but also boasts an array of weapons of mass destruction, including chemical and biological ones, and yet it lectures the world on the threat from Iran and on the virtues of nuclear non-proliferation. Analysts consider the U.S. position on the nuclear weapons actually a multi-layered cake of highly transparent double standards, one way of describing it. Does the U.S. exercise this manufactured threat to prevent economic and political advancement, like in Iran's case?
Look, there can be no doubt that there is a large element of hypocrisy in the American position regarding nuclear weapons. You know, we were one of the nations that pushed for the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty holds that there are five declared nuclear powers, and that the world will be limited to these five.
Okay, what do you think, Behrad, of what our guest there said? I mean, do you agree with Scott on U.S. nuclear hypocrisy, as Scott said, and in particular whether the U.S. exercises this manufactured Iran nuclear threat to prevent economic and political advancement, which obviously is being exercised in Iran's case, it appears?
Well, NPT is both a success and a failure. It started at the time that there were no mutual trust between the nations, and the world was bipolar, the communists versus the free world. The communists controlled all the communist countries which fell under the umbrella, and by most, the United States controlled the free world on one side. Under those circumstances, they brought the NPT, hoping that they would prevent other nations develop nuclear weapons in exchange for helping with the peaceful nuclear development, and also with the main promise that they would agree over time to reduce to eliminate their nuclear weapon.
That was Behrad talking there. And also Scott Ritter, prior to him, former UN Chief Weapons Inspector, Behrad, a nuclear scientist and engineer. Okay, I'm going to be right back with the Info News section, but first, let's take a look at other countries and their nuclear stockpiles. It's time for our InfoNews, a section where we take a look at other economic news from around the world. Our first stop is China. We're going to take a look at China's yuan. What has occurred? The share of China's yuan of global currency reserves, which are held by global central banks, have reached a new high, that high being 2.45% in the first quarter of 2021. Now, the yuan's previous forex share was 2.2%. That happened in the last quarter of 2020. Comparatively speaking, the greenback share currently stands at 59.5%, with the euro and the yen far behind, standing at 20.57% and 5.89%, respectively. However, that's an increase on the yuan, so we wanted to point that out. Next, the OPEC oil production. Oil has surged. Prices are incredible. $75 per barrel is the latest that we have on that. It could be up to 76, at least as of the recording of this program, it was at around $75. Reports have emerged that OPEC and its non-OPEC partners like Russia and also Iran were discussing another gradual increase in oil supply of 2 million barrels per day to happen between August and December. Now, as of the recording of this program, OPEC delayed its decision on producing more oil. Next up, U.S. spending. Under the microscope of the IMF, it has issued a statement. It says that the U.S. spending should be prioritized. What areas should it be prioritized into? Well, it says spending should focus on productivity, labor force, and on poverty. So the IMF actually pointing out where the U.S. spending should be. We've talked about military and nuclear weapons also, but will the U.S. listen? I mean, who knows? Maybe it'll listen to the IMF. Finally, a study has come out on world debt. It says that debt could trap low-income nations into poverty. The report said that heavy debt burdens may generate a permanent global divergence between rich and poor countries, that while the international community was likely to help countries facing difficulties on debt resolution, for that to actually be a mechanism in order to reduce the debt. Now, my final thoughts are coming up next. Upgrading and modernizing nuclear weapons requires massive spending, like the $1 trillion or more that the U.S. is going to be spending over the next 30 years. And to say that one nuclear bomb can destroy the Earth many times over, well, you've heard that before. It's just played out. It's a repeat. To also say that the U.S. can spend this money wisely in other ways, well, that's also played out, but it's worth repeating. I mean, there are around 40 million Americans that require food assistance, aside from the poverty in that country and homelessness. You heard U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders saying how U.S. infrastructure and schools need money. Well, the problem in the U.S. is that military manufacturers, hand-in-hand with the Pentagon, they rule the U.S. political system, including the U.S. president. What other explanations can there be for all the U.S. military bases, the cost involved, the director of covert military engagements around the world, the cost involved there, and most recently how the U.S. alleges there are threats from China and Russia, more reasons to spend money on the military. And finally, comes the U.S. double standard on nuclear weapons. You can't have it, the U.S. says, only I can. And this is most evident in the way that the U.S. has dealt with Iran, preventing Iran from pursuing its civilian nuclear program. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. From Yikova Tafli and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
In the limelight. Texas Republicans move legislation to overhaul the state's voting system closer to passage on Sunday, 11th of July, brushing aside fierce opposition from Democrats to gain approval from key committees in the House and the Senate after marathon weekend hearings. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist David Montgomery. The piece is titled, After Marathon Hearings, Texas Republicans Advance Voting Measure. Texas Republicans move legislation to overhaul the state's voting system closer to passage on Sunday, 11th of July, brushing aside fierce opposition from Democrats to gain approval from key committees in the House and the Senate after marathon weekend hearings. The committee votes, coming just days into a 30-day special session, adhere to Governor Greg Abbott's timetable for swift action on the legislation, which he has called a priority for his administration. The full 31-member state Senate is expected to vote on its bill as early as Tuesday, 13th of July. The 150-member House is also likely to take up its own version of the measure this week. Democrats on both committees united in opposition to the bills and prepared for further combat on the floors of the Senate and the House. Beverly Powell, a state senator from the Fort Worth suburb who voted against the bill in committee, said Senate Democrats were planning many amendments during the floor debate and might even try to introduce an alternative bill. The Senate State Affairs Committee took about 45 minutes on Sunday afternoon to approve the bill, known as SB1, on a 6-3 party line vote after slightly modifying the bill with 9 Republican amendments. "We feel good about the bill," said Brian Hughes, the Republican committee chairman. Earlier, the committee was in session for nearly 15 hours until about 1:30 a.m. on Sunday, 11th of July, hearing testimony from more than 200 witnesses, many of them opposed to the bill. The hearings before the House committee went even longer, concluding at about 7:30 a.m. on Sunday, 11th of July, with a vote to approve the bill after nearly 24 hours of debate and public comment. All 9 Republicans on the committee supported the bill, while the 5 Democrats voted against it. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, has said that passing a new voting law is one of his top priorities. He called the legislature into the special session, which started on Thursday after Democrats blocked the bill in late May with an 11th-hour walkout from the Capitol that denied Republicans a quorum. Hundreds of Texans flocked to the Capitol over the weekend for the committee hearings on the campaign voting bills being pushed by Republicans, part of a national effort by the party to impose new restrictions on state election systems. Republicans say the restructuring is necessary to improve voter integrity, but Democrat-aligned opposition forces are fighting what they call an unprecedented campaign to suppress voting rights. "This is the single greatest coordinated attack on democracy in our lifetime, and perhaps in the life of this country," said Beto O'Rourke, a former U.S. representative and candidate for president, who has taken a lead role for Democrats on the voting issue and was at the Capitol for the hearing. But Mr. Hughes, the Republican chairman, opened the hearing on Saturday by declaring that the legislation was designed to create a better election process that's safe and accessible. House and Senate Democrats have vowed to do everything necessary to kill the legislation a second time, but their options are limited. They have hinted that they are prepared to resort to another bold move, such as staging another walkout or possibly taking the more extreme step of fleeing the state. Studies consistently rate Texas near the top of the list of states that make it harder to register and vote, which explains in part why the Democrats view the stakes as so high. The voting bills would ban 24-hour voting and drive-through voting sites, increase the criminal penalties for election workers who run afoul of regulations, limit what assistance could be provided to voters, and expand the authority and autonomy of partisan poll watchers, among other provisions. But 2 provisions from the earlier session that Democrats had vehemently opposed were removed: a limitation on Sunday voting and a proposal that would have made it easier to overturn an election. for the hearings over the weekend, Democrats and voter advocacy groups opposed to the bills had rallied witnesses from around the state to testify. State Senator Boris Miles, a Houston Democrat, said two busloads of witnesses and a 20-car caravan had made the trip from his district. Both Boris Miles and Linda Hidalgo, the chief executive of Harris County in Texas, the state's most populous county, told reporters that the bills would extract a harsh toll in the Houston region by dismantling election innovations, such as 24-hour voting, that were put in place during the 2020 presidential election. "We're under attack," Boris Miles said. After getting a late start on the voting measure by spending hours on a bill, on a bail overhaul bill, the House committee worked through the night to hear many of the nearly 300 witnesses who had signed up to testify. Several who were still waiting in the committee room past dawn began to joke about the time and expressed gratitude to Trent Ashby, the Republican House chairman, for not shutting off the testimony. "Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for staying," said Hector Mendez, representing the group Texas College Democrats. "Happy 6:30 a.m. to all of you," another witness said. Although Democrats sought more time to digest the bill, Mr. Ashby said he wanted to proceed with a committee vote because of the compressed nature of the special session. Before voting to send the measure to the full House, the committee also rejected 8 amendments offered by Democrats, also along party line votes. Texas follows several other battleground states controlled by Republicans that have passed substantial overhauls of their election laws and enacted new voting restrictions this year. Since January, at least 22 bills that make voting more difficult have been signed into law in 14 states.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 1-9395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Around the World with Reporters.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war against Yemen in 2015, thousands of Yemenis, including businessmen, have been forcibly displaced from Saudi territories due to their sympathy with their country. Others have been imprisoned and tortured on charges of being Houthis.
The Saudi authorities practice various types of violations against Yemenis residing in the kingdom. The number of forcibly displaced people from Saudi Arabia, according to the International Organization for Migration, has reached more than 49,000. Saudi Arabia began practicing enforced disappearance and torture of Yemenis because of their sympathy with the countrymen since the beginning of war. This is considered a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Abdul Latif al-Hashimi is one of those displaced from Saudi Arabia. He has established a foundation in Sana'a to expose the Saudi practices against Yemenis and to help those who feel alienated upon their arrival in Yemen after spending decades of their lives in Saudi Arabia. Al-Hashimi says some Yemenis have been displaced or imprisoned because of their last name if it refers to a Hashimi family.
There are Yemenis imprisoned in Saudi Arabia on charges of being Houthis, belonging to a particular sect, or because of their last name if it refers to Hashemite family. Even those who show sympathy with their countrymen suffering from the Saudi war and blockade are imprisoned. Others have their money and trade confiscated. We seek to help those who are deported to Yemen, as most of them feel alienated upon their return to Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The brutal war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
The grievance of forcibly displaced Yemenis from Saudi Arabia exposes another aspect of Riyadh's violations of the humanitarian law. People here say all this comes amid the apathy of most international human rights bodies. Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
More than 2,000 Palestinian teenagers have attended a summer camp held by the Islamic Jihad armed wing to get more familiar with the Palestinian cause and receive due military training for possible confrontation with the Israeli army.
The camp aims to raise the awareness of the Gaza teenagers about the Palestinian cause. Israeli regime thinks that by waging war, it can undermine the spirit of our nation. Camps like this make our children prepared to stand up for their rights against the Zionist violence.
The camp was inaugurated in a ceremony attended by a number of political and military leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement. The leaders said the camp seeks to make the new generation more familiar with the Palestinian cause and demolish the concept of normalizing ties with Israel in their minds.
This camp aims to give training to the young generation on the resistance front's war strategies against the Israeli regime. A number of participants have lost one or more relatives during the latest escalation, and they are here to learn how to cope with the next atrocities.
The number of participants this year was significantly higher compared to previous years. The resistance factions attribute this huge participation to the big victory they achieved against Israel in the last escalation over the Strip.
We came here to learn how to defend our lands. We want history to write about us and how we seek to liberate Jerusalem al-Quds. My message to the Israeli occupation is that the youngest olive tree in our land is older than your whole entity. We are the generation that witnessed wars and killings, and that's why we will keep the resistance and will not give up our land.
The Islamic Jihad says these camps also carry a message to Israel that the Palestinian factions are always ready to defend their rights. Observers here say among its responsibilities, the resistance front should narrate the true history of resistance for new generations to help them understand the true face of the Israeli regime. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Latest figures from the International Organization for Migration show so far this year 898 refugees have died in the Mediterranean Sea while trying to reach EU soil. That's three times more compared to the same period last year. The subject has, yet again, just been debated in the European Parliament.
Europe is no longer in a migration crisis.
That remark by EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson has incensed many lawmakers.
It is quite surprising to be here listening to this debate, and suddenly the Commissioner says the EU is no longer in a migration crisis. Commissioner, what planet are you living on?
Legislators and rights groups highlight reports that EU countries such as Greece and Italy are aggressively pushing refugee vessels away from their shores. Other EU nations like Austria and Hungary have closed their borders to these desperate people. A €6.3 billion fund has been agreed by the European Parliament to help member states manage the refugee issue.
We first need to see improvements in respect for fundamental rights and accountability, and this funding should be made conditional upon fundamental rights compliance.
The EU is continuing its policy of sending billions of euro to Turkey and Libya so that authorities there prevent the flow of refugees to the 27-nation bloc.
Throughout this, European leaders keep resorting to populist solutions of making it harder and harder for people to reach safety.
Campaigners say at no point since the crisis started in 2015 has the EU taken responsibility. They say the main source of the problem relates to attempts by Western powers to destroy and take over Syria. Now EU leaders are being urged to show some compassion and solidarity.
Finally, take political responsibility to break the deadlock in the Council and to agree on a common European asylum system.
However, rights groups say that is wishful thinking. Anti-refugee politicians such as Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban have the power to veto any proposals that are presented here. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The global call for reparations is growing louder by the day as news emerges that Jamaica's government is set to demand reparations from Queen Elizabeth II and the British government for Great Britain's role in the transatlantic slave trade. A petition has been prepared and will be submitted in due course, according to Olivia Bazby Grange, Jamaica's Minister for Culture. The announcement comes not long after UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet urged global action, including reparations, to, quote, make amends to people of African descent.
And of course, it's long, long, long overdue. And I like the way that the Jamaican representatives have phrased it. They have said, quite frankly, that if we're prepared, or if Britain is prepared to repay the enslavers or the descendants of the enslavers up until, just a few years ago, yeah, then they must equally be prepared to repay the descendants of the enslaved.
Over 3 million enslaved Africans were forcibly trafficked across